All right, we are coming to the book of Ezekiel again. We're going to actually pick it up in verse chapter 8 and try to go from there of the book of Ezekiel, because it's actually starting a whole new section of the book of Ezekiel from chapter 8 through chapter 11. We're dealing with the sin and the fate of Jerusalem. What sins that Ezekiel was given privy to understanding and seeing were actually going on right within the very temple of God at Jerusalem. The breaking and the idolatry. In chapter 8, we find that the prophet Ezekiel is transported in spirit to Jerusalem. Here he is abiding in Babylon on the river Kibar, but God's capable of transporting him in vision to Jerusalem, where he beholds and he describes four forms of idolatry practiced in the temple. And we will be dealing with those. We see in chapter 8 that the slaughter of the idolatrous inhabitants. In chapter 9, we deal with the destruction of Jerusalem by fire. Chapter 10, we see the abandonment of the city and the sanctuary by the Lord. And then in chapter 11, we see the prediction of a restoration of the children to Jerusalem and to that area. So it kind of makes you wonder, in modern day Israel, if God were to send a prophet like Ezekiel into the holy places of our country, would he see some of the same idolatrous things going on that was going on in Jerusalem? And here, the very temple of God, they had idol worship. They had worshiping of pagan gods and goddesses, and they were bowing down to Baal and to Tammuz and to other pagan gods and goddesses. So it was not a pretty picture that Ezekiel was able to see and to look at. So coming to chapter 8 and verse 1, it says, "And it came to pass in the sixth year, in the sixth month, in the 50th day of the month," or fifth day of the month, "as I sat in my house, and the elders of Judah sat before me, that the hand of the Lord fell there upon me." So here he was with the elders of Judah there in Babylon on the river of Kibar. And God's hand fell on him, and he says, verse 2, "Then I beheld, and lo, a likeness as the appearance of fire from the appearance of his loins even downward. Fire and from his loins even upward, as the appearance of the brightness as the color of amber." Obviously a symbolism of Christ and of the God of the Old Testament. "And he put forth the form of a hand, and he took me by the lock of mine head." It's not recommended as a child parenting practice, by the way, to take children by the locks of the head. But here he took Ezekiel, and he took him by the lock of the hair, and the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and heaven, and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem, to the door of the inner gate that looks toward the north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy which provoked to jealousy. This is right in the very house of God that they had brought in what God calls a god of, or the image of jealousy, or in the other translations it says that image to bring about jealousy. You know, God says he is a jealous God for his people. And when he sees his people Israel that he he bought and he gave birth to. And he sees those same people going out now and doing all kinds of things that were contrary to what his instructions were and his thoughts were and his ways. And he is a jealous God for his people. And I think we ought to thank God that he is a jealous God, you know? That is a blessing, not a curse, that God is jealous over us. And so he brought him to the north gate, the way looking to the north. And in verse 4, behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, according to the vision that I saw in the plain. And then said he unto me, Son of man, lift up your eyes now the way toward the north. You see, the east gate, looking out toward the Kidron Valley and then across the Kidron Valley over to the Mount of Olives, was out the east gate. The north gate was actually where most of the people came and went. That was the most well-traveled of the gateways in the temple, was from the north to the south. And the east gate actually was rarely ever used. In fact, it's not going to be used again, it says, until Christ returns. And he's going to open it up again. And he said, verse 6, and he said furthermore unto me, Son of man, do you see what they do, even the great abominations that the house of Israel commits here, that I should go far off from my sanctuary, but turn you yet again, and you shall see greater abominations? In other words, what God is saying is, these abominations are going to drive me away from you. They're going to separate you and me, and they're going to bring about, as we will see in a few minutes, some pretty catastrophic situations in our lives. It's going to lead to a decimation of people. Pretty bad fate for Jerusalem and for Israel in what they were going to do. So coming on down, he says in verse 6, he said furthermore to me, Son of man, do you see what they do, even the great abominations? Verse 7, and he brought me to the door of the court, and when I looked, behold, a hole was in the wall. And then he said to me, Son of man, dig now into the wall. And when I had digged into the wall, behold, there was a door. And he said to me, go in and behold the wicked abominations that they do here. And as I said a while ago, from a religious perspective, if we were to look at modern day Israel, what would God see going on? In his nationally, in his war, in his countries, in his people, he says in verse 10 that they... When I went in and I saw, and behold, every form, a creeping thing, an abominable beast, and all of the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. You know, they were worshiping all kinds of beasts. They were bowing down to all kinds of four-footed and creeping things and abominable beasts. Doesn't mean that they were just necessarily eating them, but they were worshiping. I think we have come a long ways toward worshiping all kinds of idols, even animals. And animals are made by God. They were created by God, but they are not human beings. You know, and but we can make them almost more important. I remember one time when... fellow student at Ambassador College, when she was going to get married, and they were going to be contributing a certain amount of money to certain things, and she said, well, I want to contribute my money to the animals, because I think, you know, there's God's got plenty of people to contribute toward taking care of human beings. I'm going to take care of all the animals. Well, I'm not against giving to animal shelters and other things either, but in fact, we do. I get sort of tired of their evolutionary theories all the time and those spouting of various things. And I even get tired of watching National Geographic because of they're always talking about evolution and how God brought things into being. They can never acknowledge God for who he is, but they will look to the animals and everything else. And we live in just the same world. We forget God and we look to other things. In verse 11, he says, "And there stood before them 70 men of the ancients of the house of Israel." 70 being the Sanhedrin, or the elders, the body of spiritual people from Israel. And these ancients of Israel, the leaders of Israel, they stood in the midst. And one of them was Jehazaniah, the son of Shaphan, with every man his censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. And then said he unto me, "Son of man, you have seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the chambers of his imagery. For they say, the Lord sees us not, and the Lord has forsaken the earth." I guess the question that we need to ask ourselves, as ancient Israel should have asked themselves, is there ever a time when God doesn't see what's going on? But they thought, well, God isn't looking. God doesn't see us. I mean, we're in the dark. We're away from what he is doing. We can get by with it. Do we ever sometimes think, well, we can get by with certain behavior and certain things because God isn't aware of it? Maybe he's forgotten about us. Or that the Lord has forsaken the earth and gone way off. But he said to me, "Turn you yet again, and you shall see even greater abominations." That was only part of it, that the ancients, the very elders of the body. I guess I can't help but read this chapter and Ezekiel 33 and Jeremiah 23 and Ezekiel 34 and other scriptures that deal with the shepherds of Israel. And you begin to ask yourself, is God just talking about, in quote, those shepherds of the world's religions out there? And I don't think he is. I think there's an application that we have to be aware of, that not everything that goes on in the house of God is pure and upright and perfect. And if you're in the church because you think everybody in the church is perfect, you're in the wrong place, okay? Because we're still human beings, subject to human emotions and subject to human weaknesses. As I said earlier today, I mean, we have ministry that are facing challenges when it comes to racial feelings. They're, with God's help, striving to change and overcome it. But let's face it, if you were brought up in certain areas and certain places, and all of your young adulthood and young life was spent in a certain way of thinking, it's not easy to change, is it? Not easy. I was brought up in a part of the country that I never had a problem with the racial feelings between black and white, because there weren't any black people where I was brought up. It was just nobody there. But we did have other minority groups. And there's a lot more of them now. I went back to not long ago and talking to my younger brother up in Oregon. And where I was born was Jefferson, Oregon, which is just a very small little community. And he said, well, you wouldn't even recognize it now. He says 90-some percent of the population of Jefferson, Oregon are Mexicans. There weren't any of them there at the time I was there. But it's a farming community, and it's all from the Hispanic peoples who are working in the farm groups and in the farm areas. And he said it's just a little Mexico. There weren't any when I was there, and that's not that many years ago. But it's hard. And depending on where you were brought up, if you were brought up in Alabama back in the 50s and the 60s, you're going to have a different feeling than what I would have having been growing up in Oregon. But what we have to realize is that there's only one measure, and that is the truth of God, right? How we meet that measure has to do with where we were brought up and how we were brought up, and whether we, and the need for God's help to change, to grow, and to mature, and whatever it takes. But we all are going to be subject to certain things. I think of those people in South Africa during the time of the Boers and apartheid. Very difficult. Very difficult. And you cannot just say automatically, well, when I was baptized and I went under that water, all my feelings of race and everything else just disappeared. Don't you wish? Don't you wish? So he says, well, the Lord doesn't see us, and the Lord is not. He's gone way off. He's forsaken us, so we can go do what we want now. But then he said to Ezekiel, you turn and you go and you look, and you'll see even greater abominations. And then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north. And behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Of all things, here you got a pagan deity, Tammuz, that's being worshipped. Now, I don't know everything there is to know about Tammuz and who she was or who he was, I mean. But I do know it was a pagan god. And let me just read what this one statement about Tammuz. It says, this god can be traced back to the Sumerian Dumuzi, the god of the subterranean ocean and a shepherd deity, whose sister consort, Inanna Ishtar, descended into the lower world to bring him back to life. In his worship are similarities to that of the Egyptian Osiris and the Canaanite Baal and Assyrian Adonis. And it says the nightly death of the god, the gods dying before the touch of the winter of the vernal gods dying with the parched summer are variations on the theme of death and the resurrection. So all of these various worship services dealing with the death and the resurrection. My personal belief is that God, who knew that he was going to be his son, or give his son, and he was going to die, and he was going to be resurrected, that Satan also, to some degree, knew that and deliberately brought about certain worship services and certain worship behaviors based upon what he knew God was going to be doing later. Idol worship. And a lot of idol worship has to do with death and the resurrection. And that's when Tammuz was most you know, the resurrection service or whatever. But it says human sacrifice, castration, virginity, and sexual union formed a part of the cult rites at one time or another. So he says here the Jewish women are seen engaged in the sorrowful rites of the vegetation myth involving worship of Tammuz. So God took Ezekiel and he said, you look down there in my own house and look at what they're doing. He says in verse 14, and then he brought me to the house of the gate to the north, and he says they were weeping for Tammuz. It's an emotional worship service or feelings. And then said he unto me, have you seen this, and the, O son of man? Turn here and I'll show you even a greater one. And he brought me to the inner court of thy Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord itself, I mean the inner holy of holies, in God's temple. He says, between the porch and the altar were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of God, of the Lord, and their faces toward the east. Can you imagine that? That literally they had their backs toward where God's presence would have been, there in the Holy of Holies, with the back there, and they were facing to the east, to the rising of the sun. Doesn't make you realize why Christ was saying some of the things he did about turning their backs to God. And he says they worship the sun toward the east. The sun being basically the origin of life, you know, from many ways, that without the sun there would be no life. But then, as Paul says in the book of Romans, chapter 1, they worship the creation more than they worship the Creator, right? That's just human. It's been interesting. My daughter has told me a little bit. Have any of you been watching any of the programs on the Weather Channel about the weather that changed the course of history? You watch it? Anyway, she is just enthralled by the whole series because they're going through major changes in history that came about as a result of changes in weather. Whether it had been cyclones or whether it was tornadoes or whether it was volcanoes or earthquakes or any number of other things. But it's not just once or twice. I mean, we may have heard about Dunkirk and we may have heard of a few places, but it's been repeated over and over and over again that the course of history. See, Waterloo was brought about by certain weather. The problems of the Germans going into Russia during World War II and how they got bogged down in unusually cold weather. Apparently, they were saying that the weather was something like 60s below zero. And it's also interesting to realize that the Russians had old-fashioned equipment that would operate in cold weather. The Germans had all this new fandangled equipment, and it wouldn't work in the cold weather. Sometimes it's better to have the old stuff. See, some of us are, you know, age makes better. No. That way? Yeah? So, but during Waterloo, during the time of Napoleon, you will also see weather that changed the world. But then you can read in the Old Testament, and you will find many accounts in the Old Testament where God used weather to change the world too. I mean, when you read in the book of Genesis, then the days of Peleg, when the world was divided. I mean, we might just read over that, but come on. What happened during the days of Peleg when the world was divided? pretty traumatic events when are going on. There is a possibility that that may have been when actually the continents were formed. You know, that theory that the Earth was all one at one time, and one mass, and that it's a separation, that they were being pushed apart, could have happened during the days of Pele. I don't know. But there are many other times. I remember reading a book one time called Earth and Upheaval by Valakovsky. Talks about many of the traumatic events down through the history of mankind and before that. So anyway, he said, you look in there and just see what's going on. They're worshiping the sun. I know my life depends on the sun and the sunshine, but I don't worship the sun. I worship the one who made the sun and gave the sun for its right purpose. Says, then he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence, and they have returned to provoke me to anger. And lo, they put the branch to their nose. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that means, put the branch to the nose. I didn't really look too much, but therefore will I also deal in fury, and my eye shall not spare, and neither will I have pity, and though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, I will not hear them. So when Christ comes back, and when hopefully we are still alive and we're going to be able to witness some of the traumatic events that take place at the end of time and the end of this age, and some of the catastrophic events that are going to be happening, earthquakes in differing places, tidal waves, who knows what. God's fury is going to be poured out upon modern day Israel. And we have to believe what he says, that he is justified in his treatment of his people. He is justified in what he is doing. And the more we understand that God is righteous and he is right, the better we are. Chapter 9 is dealing with the vision of the slaughter of the guilty, the judgment on Jerusalem, and that fact that God's glory leaves, and he disappears. But in chapter 9, Ezekiel was given insight, and he was given the opportunity to have a vision of this slaughter, and he cried unto me in mine ears. He says, cause them that have charge over the city to draw near, even every man with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men came from the way of the higher gate, which lies toward the north. And that was the main way through the temple. And every man a slaughter weapon in his hand. And one man among them was clothed with linen, with a writing inkhorn by his side. And they went in, and they stood beside the brazen altar. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereupon he was to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed with linen, and who had the writer's inkhorn. And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, which was a type of modern-day Israel. And he says, set a mark upon the foreheads of the men, Now, you can read similar situations in the book of Revelation. But what God said, put a mark upon the foreheads, set them aside for a special purpose and a reason. But he said, mark those in the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that are done in the midst thereof. Like we look at that today, and what we might realize is that God is looking for people who are sighing and crying for the sins of modern day Israel. That we feel sick when we know what's going on. The idolatry and the pagan worship service and whatever. But do we feel sorry? And do we express that? Hoping and praying for God's intervention and his divine healing. In verse 5, and he said to the others, he said, in your hearing, go after him through the city and smite. In other words, all of those who do not have a sign upon their head. Reminds you of Exodus chapter 12, doesn't it? Where if they didn't have the blood upon the two doorposts, the death angel came, didn't it? During the book of Revelation, you find where there was a mark. Not the mark of the beast, but there were other signs upon people who were God's people. And they were separated and sealed. We must be sealed by the Spirit of God as a church and as a body of people and as God's people, that we have been marked by God. And to the others, he said, well, they're going to be smitten. Let not your eyes despair, and neither have you pity. Just fulfill what I tell you. Kind of reminds you of what God had, or Samuel had said to Saul. You kill every man, woman, and child, and animal of the Amalekites, I think it was, the Amalekite. And he didn't do it. He listened to what people said. He listened to, according to his words, he spared the best for an offering. God doesn't need animals. He wants obedience. But he says, slay utterly old and young, both maids and little children and women. You know, it's not going to be a pretty time. And if we don't believe that God is righteous in his judgment, we might have reason to be upset over it and angry over it. And we have to be willing and able to see it from God's perspective of what sin is. That we might have a little difficulty when it comes down to seeing men and women, young and old, maids and little children and women. But he said, do not come near any man upon whom is the mark. And began at the sanctuary. Uh-oh. Began in the house of God. That's where it starts. Begins with the ministry. Begins with those that are in power and in authority. So he said, you begin at the sanctuary and the ancients. Then coming on down, he said, defile the house and fill the courts with the slain, and go you forth. And they went forth and slew this in the city. And it came to pass while they were slaying them, and I was left, that I fell upon my face. And I cried. And I said, oh, Lord God, will you destroy all the residue of Israel in your pouring out of your fury upon Israel or upon Jerusalem? So, you know, we may not want to see it. What we need to realize when we are praying thy kingdom come, you're also praying for some pretty violent times to come in the near future, right? It's the only way God's kingdom is going to be established. And then he said to me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is exceedingly great. And the land is full of blood and the city full of perverseness. For they say, the Lord has forsaken the earth and the Lord does not see. In other words, to say that God doesn't have any concern anymore and that he has forsaken the earth and humankind and that he isn't looking is perverseness, he said. And as for me also, mine eye shall not spare, and neither shall I have pity, but I will recompense their way upon their head. I was talking earlier in the sermon. How does God judge? By actions. By recompensing their way. And behold, the man clothed with linen and inkhorn by his side reported the matter, saying, I have done as you have commanded me. I've fulfilled. I've gone in and I've slaughtered everybody that has not been marked. What it behooves all of us is to be marked children of God. Chapter 10, which we're not going to go into tonight, deals with the departure of God's glory from the temple. He actually leaves and departs. And take his going by his cherubs and his wings. And so we'll pick up with chapter 10 next time. I think we better quit there for today.